I presume most of you are familiar with Charles Spurgeon. He was the arguably, in fact, I would say almost indisputably, the greatest Baptist preacher of all time. He was young and single when he was asked to fill the pulpit of London's most important Baptist congregation, the New Park Street Chapel, it was called at the time. Spurgeon was literally still a teenager, just 19 and a half years old. He was also a fairly young believer. He had become, he'd been saved less than 4 years earlier. Both his father and his grandfather had were pastors, and so even before his conversion, Spurgeon had gained an academic knowledge of Scripture and doctrine and ministry philosophy. He began reading his grandfather's Puritan books before he was age six. So that gives you an idea of his literary skill and his intelligence. And as a young teenager, he had struggled to understand the gospel and find assurance of salvation. But he later said that the preaching of that era was a detriment and not a help to his struggle. Preachers that he heard always stressed the law and the Ten Commandments and the moral duties of righteous living, and that they were either silent or unclear on the question of how sinners might be saved. And so now he's a preacher himself. Spurgeon felt very deeply the duty of proclaiming the gospel as clearly as possible to as many people as possible. He never preached a sermon without working the gospel in some way. And therefore, he had begun to preach around Cambridgeshire soon after his conversion. He was 15 when he was converted. He began, despite his youthfulness, he quickly gained a reputation as a skilled and persuasive preacher. And he had been a believer barely more than a year when he was asked to become the pastor of the Baptist Church at Waterbeach, which was a community about 10 miles north of Cambridge. Spurgeon had spent his entire childhood in rural Essex. He had attended mostly nonconformist chapels, congregationalist churches. They baptized infants. These were not Baptist churches. But in the years after his conversion, he pastored this rural church in Cambridgeshire, and the cosmopolitan culture of London was completely foreign to him. He had, as far as I know, never been to London even. And he was first asked to fill the pulpit at New Park Street, London, as a guest preacher on December 18th of 1853. And I think he had every expectation that this would be a one-time event. This was London's oldest and best-known Baptist church. It was already 200 years old when Spurgeon went there to be the guest speaker. The church was founded around 1650 when nonconformist religious gatherings were illegal under English law. And so the first congregations met secretly. The church had previously been pastored by three luminaries, starting with Benjamin Keach in 1668. Keach pastored this congregation for 36 years, and his seminal work has been influential in shaping Baptist theology from then until today. I have some of Keach's books in my library. The earliest Baptist confessions of faith were largely his work. He's worthy of the utmost respect. John Gill was called to pastor this congregation in 1720, and he led that church for more than 50 years. He wrote several important works, including a commentary on the whole Bible and a massive textbook on Bible doctrine titled A Body of Divinity, A Body of Doctrinal and Practical Divinity. It's a long title. Gill's works are still in print today, and they're also in the public domain, so you can get them in electronic form in most of the Bible study software programs. Gill's influence and his reputation were still strongly felt in this congregation. When Spurgeon arrived there, he's a century after Gill. So Gill was 100 years before Spurgeon. And after Gill came John Rippon, who began his ministry as a young man, age 22, and he remained as pastor there for 63 years until He died at age 85. And like his famous predecessors, he was a capable theologian. But what we remember Ripon for, his most lasting contribution, was in the realm of church music. He compiled the first Baptist hymnal. It's just called something like A Selection of Hymns. So you'll see it actually referred to in our hymnal where it lists the tune or it lists the origin of a hymn. It'll say this hymn was like number 12 in Ripon's selection. So it was a very influential hymn book. I lost my place in my notes. He was considered the foremost authority on Isaac Watts's hymns. He knew them all and compiled collections of them. The influence of all three of these previous pastors hung over the congregation at the New Park Street Chapel. The building had been constructed just 3 years before John Ripon died, and so when Spurgeon came there as guest speaker, the building was only 20 years old. It was located on the south bank of the River Thames, and it was not a small chapel. Its seating capacity was 1,200. This was, in fact, the largest auditorium Spurgeon had ever spoken to, and so he came with a feeling of inadequacy and great trepidation. He described that first visit to London in an article that he wrote several years later for The Sword and the Trowel, the magazine he started. And he mentioned that when he came there as guest speaker, he did not receive VIP treatment. He writes, quote, "We lodged for the night at a boarding house in Queen Square, Bloomsbury, to which the worthy deacon directed us." He was using the royal we when he says we lodged. By the way, he uses that plural pronoun, and when he does that, it's not to signify that someone else was with him. He was there alone, and it was a two-mile walk from his boarding house to New Park Street Chapel. The chapel was on the opposite side of the river. Boarding house was on the north side. The chapel was just on the south bank. You can see the route there in the PowerPoint. And Spurgeon had to make that lonely walk through unfamiliar streets in the December cold on Sunday morning in order to get there in time. He continues, "We wore a huge black satin stock and used a blue handkerchief with white spots." Now, a stock is a kind of medieval-looking Victorian-era piece of formal wear for men. It's a fabric wraparound that covers the entire neck from chin to shoulders. It looks terribly uncomfortable. A black stock and a blue spotted handkerchief would clash, I imagine. Spurgeon's point in recounting these details, specifically how he dressed, was to stress that he was anything but fashionable. I don't know. I think he's a pretty good look. He continues, "The young gentlemen of that boarding house marveled greatly at the youth from the country who had come up to preach to in London, but who was evidently in the condition known as verdant green." In other words, he's saying he wasn't prepared or acclimated for urban life. And he says these young men in the boarding house were mainly of the evangelical church persuasion, and they seemed greatly tickled, he says, that the country lad should be a preacher. They did not propose to go and hear the youth, but they seemed to tacitly agree to encourage him after their own fashion. Now, he's being ironic. These men were not trying to encourage him. They were actually amused at his youthfulness and inexperience, and they were trying to intimidate him and make him nervous by recounting the greatness of so many London preachers. What spectacular oratory, what spellbinding eloquence, what impressive scholarship you could find in all the pulpits all over the city. And then Spurgeon says this, quote, "We were shown to a bed in a cupboard over the front door, not an advantageous condition for pleasant dreams." He further says, "That Saturday evening in a London boarding house was about the most depressing agency which could have been brought to bear on any spirit. On the narrow bed, we tossed in solitary misery and found no pity. The spare room hardly afforded place to kneel. We had no friend in all that city full of human beings, but we felt among strangers and foreigners. William Fullerton was a friend of Spurgeon's who, a fellow minister, who wrote a short and very readable biography. People often ask me, what's the first place to start reading if I want a brief biography of Spurgeon? I always recommend William Fullerton's biography. It was one of the first, and all the subsequent ones typically borrow from it and refer to it. William Fullerton says this. Here's how the young men at the boarding house gave him some tall talk about the wonderful preachers of London and sent him to his little bedroom so depressed that with the added noise of the street traffic, he was unable to sleep. And so the next morning, as Spurgeon walked that 2.5-mile journey to the chapel, his mood was somber. He wrote, "It was a clear, cold morning, and we wended our way along Holborn Hill toward Blackfriars and certain tortuous lanes and alleys at the foot of Southwark Bridge, wondering, praying, fearing, hoping, believing." The sight of this large church building amplified his feelings of inadequacy, but his mood began to change when he realized that there probably weren't going to be that many people in attendance. He actually was happy about that. Here's how he describes his thoughts that morning. He says, quote, "At sight of Park Street Chapel, we felt for a moment amazed at our own temerity, for it seemed to our eyes to be a large, ornate, imposing structure, suggesting an audience wealthy and critical and far removed from the humble folk to whom our ministry had been sweetness and light." He says it was early, so there were no persons entering. And when the set time was fully come, there were no signs to support the suggestion raised by the exterior of the building, and we felt that by God's help, we were not yet out of our depth, and we were not likely to be out of our depth with so small an audience. He records, and several people recorded, that the audience that morning numbered about 80, and in an auditorium built for 1,200, that surely would have seemed like a very small number. Spurgeon's sermon that morning was from James 1:17, "Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and cometh down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variableness, neither shadow of turning." And Fullerton, the biographer, writes, "One of the deacons declared after the service that morning that if the preacher were only with them for 3 months, the place would be crowded." So they were very impressed with his preaching. Fullerton says, "The news of the wonderful young man from the country spread. Visits were paid to friends during the afternoon, urging them to come in the evening, and a greatly increased congregation then gathered." Spurgeon's message in the evening service was a message on the doctrine of justification by faith from Revelation 14, verse 3. "They are without fault before the throne of God." Now, if you had been in the service, in either service that Sunday, you no doubt would have been captivated by the young preacher's clarity and conviction, and apparently had a great voice as well, although nobody ever thought to record it for us. Plus, he just had an innate skill in holding the attention of an audience. Even at that age, nervous as he was and small as he felt after a nearly sleepless night, Spurgeon's skill and his command as a preacher was impressive to the people who were there. But nothing on that occasion seemed particularly triumphant to Spurgeon himself. He said he was relieved when the day was over, and his mood was much improved. He says, When at night we trudged back to the Queen Square narrow lodging, our tone was altered. We wanted no pity of anyone. We didn't care a penny for the young gentlemen lodgers and their miraculous ministers, nor for the grind of the cabs, nor for anything else under the sun. So he slept well that night. He was glad it was over. And he recorded that he stayed over in London on Monday, and here is how he described the day. He said, "I spent Monday going about London, climbed to the top of St. Paul's." I've done that, by the way. It's a difficult climb. You see those are the actual steel, or rather iron steps that you have to go up to get there. And when you get there, you're at the very top of that, above the dome. There's a small little rotunda there, or I don't know what you call it. Yeah, I guess it would be a rotunda with a steel gate. You look out, you can see the entire city, and it's an impressive sight. But so he did it. He climbed to the top of that, and he says, I also left some money with the booksellers. So he stopped by some bookshops. He didn't expect ever to be invited back to the new Park Street. He thought it was odd that he was there in the first place. He felt out of place. He figured they would never invite him back. And he seemed surprised at the state that he found this great historic Baptist church in. Spurgeon referred to it as one of the pinnacles of the denomination, but the church had fallen into such a state of decline that, think of it, they would invite a teenager from the farmlands of Essex to speak there. And Spurgeon told his father, they don't seem to know what they're doing. And his explanation for it was that this congregation must be so spiritually malnourished that just a morsel of the gospel would be a great treat for them. He didn't think of himself as a great preacher. The plan of God's providence was much more far-reaching than Spurgeon could possibly have imagined. He didn't know it at the time, but the girl he would ultimately marry was there in that fairly small crowd of people who attended that first Sunday evening service in London. Her name was Susanna Thompson, and she had grown up in London. She was a seasoned, sophisticated young lady, accustomed to urban life and upscale manners. She was, at that time, like so many teenage girls, she was spiritually shallow, more interested in style and society than anything she might hear from the pulpit. She was not yet a believer. And so on that first Sunday evening, her sympathies would no doubt have been generally aligned with those young guys at the boarding house who had sort of mocked and tried to intimidate Spurgeon. In fact, here's how she described her impression of Charles Spurgeon on that first Sunday evening. She said this, quote, she's honest too, by the way, so brace yourself for this. She said, his countrified manners and speech excited more regret than reverence. She says, the huge stock, the badly trimmed hair, and the blue pocket handkerchief with white spots attracted most of my attention, she said, and I fear awakened some feelings of amusement. So you can conclude that she was not at all impressed on that first sight of Spurgeon. She remembered nothing of the sermon other than how amused she felt at how all of this seemed. She was actually 2 years older than Charles Spurgeon, and in her view, she was an adult at age 21. He was still a youth at 19. So she thought, who is this seriously out-of-fashion teenager from a rural village, and why does anyone think he's fit to occupy the pulpit of Benjamin Keach and Dr. Gill and Dr. Rippon? So she doesn't seem to have taken him seriously at all. She later said this, quote, there was only one sentence in the whole sermon which I carried away with me, and that solely on the account of its quaintness, for it seemed to me an extraordinary thing for the preacher to speak of the, quote, living stones in the heavenly temple perfectly joined together with the vermilion cement of Christ's blood. Now, if you ask me, that is pretty overblown phraseology. Spurgeon did outgrow the tendency to salt his sermons with that kind of artificial eloquence. But let's also take note that Spurgeon's polka-dotted handkerchief was indeed a serious fashion faux pas, and Susanna Thompson was not the only one who thought so. Fullerton says that months later, after Spurgeon was called to be their permanent pastor, he says, quote, one of the earliest presents from the deacons was a dozen white pocket handkerchiefs. A hint that it was time to put the blue handkerchief with white spots away. Fullerton says, the deacons in those days wore white cravats. That's a ornamental the predecessor of the necktie, sort of a ornamental neckband that is like a large handkerchief that went around the stock. And they wore white cravats, he says, to be in keeping with their office, and they expected their minister to do likewise. Now, obviously, London fashion, even the fashions that governed how ministers and deacons should dress, this had never been a concern of Spurgeon's. His father and his grandfather both had pastored small congregations consisting entirely of working class men and farmers and their families in these strictly agrarian cultures. And Susanna, or Susie as she became known, could hardly have been more different. Lewis Drummond, one of Spurgeon's many biographers, describes the situation this way. Drummond writes, "Susie lived with her parents, who were members of New Park Street Baptist Church. At the time of Charles's call to London, they were not very active, having lost interest because of the declining attendance in the church. Susie's father had become a prosperous merchant, a ribbon manufacturer, and she, being the only daughter, lived in quite cultured circumstances. Her background and Charles differed, one would surmise, to the point of incompatibility." That's Drummond's assessment. "And although the Thompson family had become mostly inactive church members, they actually had kept a close relationship with the family of Thomas Olney, who was a prominent deacon in the New Park Street congregation. So the Olneys and the Thompsons were related actually by marriage somehow. And it was the Olneys who invited Susie to attend on that first Sunday evening service. And she was no stranger to the venue. She had gone there with her parents many times throughout her childhood. They weren't apparently regular attenders, but she went frequently. The chapel had held a certain mystique for her. She said she always thought the pulpit resembled a magnified swallow's nest. So she didn't feel out of place there, much less, even though she was not a regular attender, she wasn't a member, she nevertheless would have considered New Park Street her home church, even though she had made no profession of faith. She had experienced a sense of deep conviction at one point in her life, you know, like a kid who goes to camp and gets under conviction and then just forgets all about it. She wasn't converted. She had gradually drifted into spiritual coldness and uncertainty, and she concealed most of her inward struggles from others, but she had grave doubts about the state of her own soul. Fear and doubt and hesitancy marked her whole religious experience at this point in her life. Drummond continues, quote, "Susanna consented to hear Charles on that first Sunday night for only one reason. She said, it would be a shame to have a man come so far and find the church so poorly attended." Drummond says she apparently had little personal spiritual concern at the time, and surely no interest at all in Charles himself. Nonetheless, she had a quiet, sweet disposition, but she found Charles not in the least attractive. It sounds like the beginning of a Hallmark movie plot, doesn't it? I mean, it's exactly, you got a sophisticated city girl with a shallow value system set to discover the superior charms of a well-seasoned, hardworking, spiritually minded country boy. Hallmark would love this. And you know what? That is exactly what happened. A remarkable love story unfolded between that young, awkward, thoroughly countrified Baptist preacher and a sophisticated but shallow, skeptical city girl in his congregation. Here's how the plot developed. To Charles Spurgeon's surprise, within a few days after that first visit to London, he received another letter from the deacons in London asking him to return not once, but three more times. Fullerton says, quote, "No other preacher who had supplied the pulpit at New Park Street during the vacant months had been invited even a second time. But Spurgeon came again on the first, third, and fifth Sundays of January 1854, and so great was the success of his ministry that on January 25th, he was invited to occupy the pulpit for 6 months with a view to permanent acceptance of the pastorate." Now, Thomas Olney, friend of Susanna's family, was undoubtedly one of the leading voices persuading the other deacons to have Spurgeon come back. He was captivated by Spurgeon's preaching from the start. And now remember, Susie didn't attend the morning service that first Sunday, but years later, this is how she described the repercussions on that day. She said, quote, "When the Olney family returned from the morning service, varied emotions filled their souls. They had never before heard just such preaching. They were bewildered and amazed, but they had been fed. They were, however, in much concern for the young preacher himself, who they thought must have been greatly discouraged by the sight of so many empty pews." Little did they know that Spurgeon was actually relieved to see a small audience, but Susie says, quote, "Deacon Olney asked, 'What can be done? We must get him a better congregation tonight or we shall lose him.' And so all that Sunday afternoon, there ensued a determined looking up of friends and acquaintances who by some means or other were coaxed into giving a promise that they would be at Park Street in the evening to hear the wonderful boy preacher." So Susie, of course, was one of the people whom the Olneys recruited to be there that night. Years later, she says, "I believe that from the very first sermon he heard him preach, dear old Father Olney's heart was fixed in his faith that God was going to do great things by this young David." Thomas Olney would, by the way, go on to serve faithfully as a deacon in that church for 15 more years under Spurgeon until Olney's death in 1869. Spurgeon said Olney was the model deacon, the man whom all the other deacons aspired to be. He had a son, William Olney, who was a cousin to Susie by marriage. He, too, would serve as a deacon for many years. So the Olney family were prominent in the church during Spurgeon's time there. While Spurgeon was filling the pulpit at New Park Street in those weeks after that first visit, he spent many evenings at the home of Thomas Olney. It was there that he met Susie face-to-face for the first time, and he gradually took an interest in her. And both Charles and Susanna later recounted how their relationship developed after Spurgeon was called to be the permanent pastor of the New Park Street Chapel. Both of them insist that at first, Charles's interest in her was strictly spiritual. As her pastor, they say he was only concerned with her spiritual growth. I think that claim probably reflects a cautious sense of typical Victorian propriety. I think he fell in love with her from the start. He already had a crush on her. As far as the record shows, he didn't ever take that level of interest in the spiritual welfare of any other lady in the congregation. He had returned to preach there again on the first Sunday of 1854. That was about a month after his first visit to London. He filled the pulpit almost every Sunday then that January, and at the end of the month, the deacons invited him to continue for six more months. They ended up calling him then to occupy the pulpit full time. Remember, it was supposed to be a six-month trial period. They called him as their permanent pastor on April 19th. Less than 3 months into what was supposed to be a six-month trial period. So the very next day after that, so he's called to be their permanent pastor on the 19th of April. The very next day, Charles gave Susie a copy of his favorite book, The Pilgrim's Progress, inscribed with these words. And this is his actual handwriting in the inscription. "Miss Thompson, with desires for her progress in the blessed pilgrimage, from C.H. Spurgeon." Susie later said, "I do not think my beloved had at that time any other thought concerning me than to help a struggling soul heavenward." She says that. She doesn't know men very well. He definitely had a crush on her by then. But she says, "I was greatly impressed by his concern for me, and the book became very precious as well." She says, "By degrees, though with much trembling, I told him of my state before God." She's telling him of her doubts of her own salvation. "And he gently led me by his preaching and by his conversations through the power of the Holy Spirit to the cross of Christ for the peace and the pardon that my weary soul was longing for." So he led her to Christ. And thus, at some point early in the spring of that year, she was converted. Now, again, I'm skeptical of the claim that Spurgeon had no romantic interest in Susie or that she had no romantic interest in him. In fact, by today's standards, the romance developed at a fairly rapid pace. Spurgeon was officially installed as pastor on April 8th, about a week after he gave that copy of the Pilgrim's Progress to Susie. He faced then a busy few weeks relocating permanently in London, arranging his duties as a pastor. His fame and his notoriety grew very quickly. Crowds were coming to hear him speak. And the critics noticed, and they attacked him for his youthfulness. They relentlessly pointed out how completely out of step his style was with Victorian sensibilities. He spoke and preached in the people's vernacular, not in the standard style of inflated religious jargon that dominated London's pulpits at the time. He was lampooned and in the secular newspapers for everything from the way he looked to his Calvinist convictions. Cartoonists caricatured him in every way possible. I particularly like this caricature. It's titled Brimstone and Treacle, which was a really clever play on the expression that people in those days would have understood, because brimstone and treacle was the name of a sort of all-purpose remedy. If you had a cold or stomach problems or whatever, you would take brimstone and treacle, and it was exactly what it sounds like. It was molasses, really sweet, treacly molasses, infused with sulfur. So the cartoonist pictures Spurgeon as brimstone, and the Anglican sissified preacher, he's treacle. It fits. Anyway, let's see. I lost my place in my notes again. Spurgeon seemed almost amused by all this criticism. He actually collected files full of it. You can see a lot of it in the autobiography of Spurgeon. And though he was amused by it, he was unmoved by it. And subtly and privately, his interest in Susie was quickly growing. And the key turning point in their relationship took place about a month and a half after he began to be the permanent pastor at the New Park Street Chapel. It was June 10th of 1854. This was the inauguration of London's famous Crystal Palace. It was a massive, elaborate, greenhouse-style venue in a South London suburb. Actually, the structure had originally been built in Hyde Park in the north side of London for the Great Exhibition of 1851. And then it was disassembled and reassembled on the south side of the river, enhanced and expanded, moved to a place called Sydenham Hill in South London, not far from where Charles and Susie ended up living. And this place was designed to be and purposed to be a kind of monument to English art and science and industry. It was surrounded by a large, well-manicured park designed for public recreation. And it was impressive by any measure. Inside, there was room for more than 40,000 people. And on that inaugural day, 40,000 people came. More than 40,000 people, because many thousands more gathered outside in the park and on the hillside surrounding the palace. And everyone was there for the opening of this wonder, including Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. So royal pomp and religious ceremony dominated this holy event. Choirs sang the 100th Psalm and Handel's Hallelujah Chorus. Susie describes it like this. A large party of our friends, including Mr. Spurgeon, were present at the inauguration, and we occupied some raised seats at the end of the palace where the great clock is now fixed. We sat there talking, laughing, and amusing ourselves as best we could while waiting for the procession to pass by. Lewis Drummond then records this fact. He says, as usual, Charles was reading a book. And he adds, how Susie liked that is unrecorded, but you can imagine. And I think there was a clever, well, I know for a fact, there was a clever strategy in Spurgeon's distraction that day. The book he was reading was a cheesy collection of poetry, Martin Tupper's book called Proverbial Philosophy. The book had been a bestseller in early Victorian times, but by 1854, while Spurgeon's there with Susie reading this book, that book had already lost its luster. One critic referred to it as charlatan poetry. It was bad poetry by any measure, written in rhythm but without rhyme. Susie herself said of the book, quote, "It was already beginning to feel the stir of the breezes of adverse criticism, which afterwards gathered into a howling tempest of disparagement and scathing sarcasm. So the book itself became a joke. And he's sitting there reading it while the queen is there. It just seemed odd. So she's no doubt unimpressed with his lack of attention to the ceremony, but also his choice of books, and wondering, I'm sure, why this book, of all things, had his attention, while right in front of him was a gala on the scale of celebration such as London had not seen and hasn't seen since, other than the coronations of their kings and queens. But the book had a chapter on marriage. It was written when the author was a young man. He was engaged to be married, and he wanted to write down, in his words, his notions on the holy estate of matrimony for his wife-to-be. In his words, he wanted to write in the manner of Solomon's Proverbs. I've read the book. It's on Google Books, or I read part of it. I couldn't stomach a whole lot of it. I will just tell you, if his goal was to write in the manner of Solomon's Proverbs, he failed. But it's clear what Spurgeon was thinking that day. Susie says, quote, "Mr. Spurgeon handed me the book and, pointing to some particular lines, said, 'What do you think of the poet's suggestion in those verses?' Now, she declares that she had zero interest in authors and their woes at that moment in particular, but she looked where his finger was pointing, and it was the opening page of this chapter on marriage, and she quotes the opening stanza of that chapter, which closes the stanza with these words, 'If thou art to have a wife of thy youth, she is now living on the earth. Therefore, think of her and pray for her weal.'" In other words, pray for her well-being, even if you don't know who she might be. So it's a message to young men. You're going to get married. If you want to get married, you should be praying for the woman who's going to be your wife, even though you don't know who that is. Not bad advice, but Charles leans over to Susie and whispers in her ear, "Do you pray for him who is to be your husband?" She said that moment was sacred in her memory for the rest of her life. She writes, "I do not remember that the question received any vocal answer, but my fast-beating heart, which sent a telltale flush to my cheeks, and my downcast eyes, which feared to reveal the light which at once dawned in them." In other words, she's realizing he does have a crush on her. She says, "That may have spoken a language which love understood. From that moment, a very quiet and subdued little maiden sat by the young pastor's side, and while the brilliant procession passed around the palace," she says, "I do not think she took so much note of the glittering pageant defiling before her as of the crowd of newly awakened emotions which were palpitating within her heart. Neither the book nor its theories were ever again alluded to, but when the formalities of the opening were over and the visitors were allowed to leave their seats, the same low voice whispered again, 'Will you come and walk around the palace with me?'" She adds this, "During that walk on that memorable day in June, I believe God himself united our hearts in indissoluble bonds of true affection, and though we knew it not, gave us to each other forever." So they were officially engaged about 2 months later on August 2nd in her grandfather's garden. Now, this was not a particularly beautiful or romantic spot. It was, in her words, this is her description, "It was a little old-fashioned garden with high brick walls on three sides and straight formal gravel paths." She said, it was a rather dreary and unromantic place for a declaration of love. But, she said, to this day, I think of that old garden as a sacred place, a paradise of happiness. Since there, my beloved sought me for his very own and told me how much he loved me. Though, she said, I thought I knew this already. It was a very different matter to hear him say it. And I trembled and was silent for joy and for gladness. She says, to me it was a time as solemn as it was sweet. And with a great awe in my heart, I left my beloved. And hastening to the house and to an upper room, I knelt before God and praised and thanked him with happy tears for his great mercy in giving me the love of so good a man. If I had known then how good he was and how great he would become, I should have been overwhelmed, not so much with the happiness of being his as with the responsibility with which such a position would entail. But thank God, throughout all my blessed married life, the perfect love which drew us together never slackened or faltered. And though I can now see how undeserving I was to be the life companion of so eminent a servant of God, I know he did not think this, but looked upon his wife as God's best earthly gift to him. And she wrote in her diary that day, August 2nd, 1854, it is impossible to write down all that occurred this morning. I can only adore in silence the mercy of my God and praise him for all his benefits. Now, if this were a Hallmark movie, it would end there, right? The credits would roll and there you go. But there's much more to the story. Spurgeon baptized Susie on the 1st of February, 1855. She says that during their 15 months of engagement, they would meet frequently at the Crystal Palace, where they would take long walks and they spent time in conversation. They had season tickets there, and so they would meet when possible on Friday afternoons after the Thursday evening church service. They had their midweek service on Thursday. But given Spurgeon's busy schedule, that could not have been an every week meeting. At one point, he preached 14 times in 6 days that year. So their other standard time to meet was Monday. And on Mondays, Spurgeon had a sermon transcript to edit for print because all of his sermons were being printed and he did the editing on them. And he had to do this every week of his life, literally until he died. He would, of necessity, bring the sermon transcript with him to finish the work during the time he spent with Susie. And so she says she learned very early how to be happy just to sit with him in silence while he worked. Darlene knows a little of what that's like. Their wedding took place on January 8, 1856, at the New Park Street Chapel, Dr. Alexander Fletcher presiding. It was a massive affair, rivaling in size, at least, what you would expect in a royal wedding. Literally thousands of people came. But the attendees were not the kind of upper-class aristocrats you would expect at any large wedding in London's West End, but to quote a report that appeared the next day in one of London's leading newspapers, they said, quote, in point of numbers and enthusiasm, the crowd far outstripped any display which the West End is in the habit of witnessing. People began to gather in the early morning hours, and when the doors opened, that 1,200-seat auditorium was immediately packed and overflowing, and 2,000 guests had to be turned away, and many of them just stood outside and listened. The wedding ceremony was simple and relatively brief, and the couple had a 10-day honeymoon in Paris. Susie had visited Paris more than once previously. She was actually proficient in French, so she guided Charles through a circuit of museums and churches because she knew of his interest in things like museums and churches. There was no Eiffel Tower at the time. And when the honeymoon was over, Spurgeon immediately became immersed in his work again. His midweek speaking schedule meant that he would be away from home many nights until late. And this was, of course, hard for Susie at first. But as she tells the story, she learned to see her sometimes lonely role as a sacrifice that she made unto the Lord. She recounted only one time when she became angry because she felt ignored or forgotten by her busy husband. She tells the story with some remorse, but she says she left the venue where he was speaking and went home alone. She, again, remorse because she came to understand that God had given Charles Spurgeon a unique and a high calling, and her role as his helpmate and partner in the work involved unusual sacrifices, and she learned to bear that burden as unto the Lord. Spurgeon was a tender-hearted and loving husband who always treated her with kindness and understanding, and you can see that clearly because many of the letters he wrote to her have been preserved. He wrote at least one letter to her every day when he was on the road and separated from her. Charles Ray wrote almost 100 years ago a short biography of Mrs. Spurgeon. He says this: Charles Haddon Spurgeon looked upon the writing of those letters as more than a loving duty to his wife, knowing how pressed he was with other correspondence that had to be attended to, and with literary work and modification of his sermons. She often used to urge him to write less often to her so that he could get more rest for himself. But, Charles Ray says, this Spurgeon would not hear of. Spurgeon himself wrote this: every word I write is a pleasure to me as much as ever it can be to you. He's writing to Susie. He says, it is only a lot of odds and ends that I send you, but I put them down as they come so that you may see it costs me no labor, but it's just happy scribble. So don't fret because I write you so many letters. It's such a pleasure to tell out my joy. Now, she, of course, loved getting those letters, and she looked forward to receiving them every day when he was away. Sometimes, she says, as an unexpected gladness, he would post two letters in one day, she says, so that I might be comforted concerning him. On an important tour, the letters would be illustrated by many amusing pen and ink sketches. He was actually a pretty good artist. He would draw pictures of people, costumes, landscapes, trees, wells, she says, or anything that particularly struck him. Plans of the rooms he occupied in the various hotels were very frequent, she says, and these enabled me to better imagine the comfort or otherwise of his surroundings. He would also sometimes write short letters or send notes to Susie when he was working in his library in the next room at home. Even if she might be just in the next room, here's one of those short notes he wrote. Quote, I bless God every day for giving you to me. Your love lightens every burden and sweetens every care. And all of his letters are full of tender affection and absolute devotion to her. To the end of his life, he never stopped writing her those letters. Here's a sample. This one is from 1871. This is 17 years into their marriage, which is, by then, most husbands are, you know, kind of slacked off on the sending of flowers and love notes, right? I'm not saying I did, but I did. He wrote, 17 years into their marriage, my own dear one, none know how grateful I am to God for you. In all I have ever done for him, you have a large share, for in making me so happy, you have fitted me for service. Not an ounce of power has ever been lost to the good cause through you. I have served the Lord for more and never less for your sweet companionship. And then from a speaking event somewhere in the UK where large crowds were coming to hear him, he wrote this: the crowds are great, but they cannot fill the place of my beloved at home. I would rather sit with you quietly than receive the applause of thousands. And he closed one of his letters with this: 10,000 kisses all in one, dear heart. I wish I could bring them personally instead of sending them by this stupid paper. Now, they're married on January 8th of 1856. Susie became pregnant almost immediately. And on September 20th of that year, she gave birth to twin sons, Charles Jr. and Thomas. Both boys, they dressed them in dresses. Everybody did that in those days. These are boys. both of them grew up to be preachers, pastors, but the children were born at home in those days, not in the hospital, and the birth of the twins left Susie with some unspecified physical injury that she never fully recovered from. And the details of it are not known because, again, the Victorian propriety wouldn't let people record details like that, but she had a series of surgeries and treatments that actually seemed to make her problems worse. And by 1868, she was basically homebound. She writes, "In 1868, my traveling days were done. Henceforth, for many years, I was a prisoner in a sick chamber, and my beloved had to leave me when the strain of his many labors and responsibilities compelled him to seek rest away from home. These separations were very painful to hearts so tenderly united as were ours, but we each bore our share of the sorrow as heroically as we could and softened it as far as possible by constant correspondence." And as she hints at in that little excerpt, Charles Spurgeon's own health problems compelled him to seek relief in a warmer climate. He had kidney disease, gout, constant pain, and the only way he believed he got some relief by smoking cigars, that's debatable, but he could get more real relief during the cold months in London by going to the south of France where it was warmer. And so he did that for several weeks each winter. And when he made those trips abroad, he would send her long travelogues describing what he had seen and what he had done every single day he was gone. She collected these and she included several of them in the autobiography. Chapter 73 of this is the original four-volume version of Spurgeon's autobiography. It contains several of the letters he wrote while he was traveling. And on his last trip to France, he was so sick that although travel was very difficult for Susie, and she spent, I think, a lot of time in a wheelchair even, she nevertheless made that last trip to France with him. On October 26th in 1891, they left London together on the train with a party of Spurgeon's friends and fellow workers. It was the first time, actually, that Susie had ever made the annual year-end journey to a warmer climate with him. And in the providence of God, it meant she was able to spend the final 3 months of her husband's life traveling with him instead of waiting at home and following his journey through the letters that he wrote. She said she regarded those last 3 months as a gift from her sovereign and gracious God, and she described that part of her life as some of the happiest times she ever had. She wrote, "Never shall I cease to bless God for his tender mercy in permitting me to be with my beloved and to minister to his happiness and comfort during those 3 blessed months. How full of joy they were to us both, but if I had known it, they were bright with the coming glory. My eyes were holden, and I thought to keep my treasure for many long days to come." In other words, she didn't know he was on the verge of death. "How sweetly mirth and gladsomeness mingled with holy joy in those never-to-be-forgotten days. He was full of fun and childlike pleasure, hiding behind a door to surprise me, or hurrying to be first ready so he could chide the laggards when the dinner bell rang. At the table, he was the life and soul of the party, with a cheerful smile and a kind word or a tender inquiry after the health of each one. Everybody loved him. His sweetness of disposition was so apparent and so attractive. Even strangers who had never before seen him were at once drawn into the ever-widening circle of his admirers by an involuntary homage to the charm of his unique personality, and once they got there, they never desired to be released." She said during those final 3 months of her husband's life, they enjoyed, in her words, perfect earthly happiness together. But Spurgeon's health declined dramatically in mid-January, and he died. She was at Charles's side when he died at 11:05 p.m. on January 31st, 1892, in room 14 at the Beau Rivage Hotel in Mentone, France. That was his favorite location in the French Riviera. They actually put a plaque in that hotel, signifying that Spurgeon had died there. And then they tore the whole hotel down and built a new one. And the plaque that they wrote, they shipped off to the Metropolitan Tabernacle. If you ever go there, ask someone to show it to you. It's up the stairs going to the church office, but they'll show it to you. Anyway, in the moments just after Charles Spurgeon left this world, Susie said she knelt and said a prayer of thanksgiving for the treasure so long lent to her. Now, I mustn't leave the impression that during the years of their marriage, Charles Haddon Spurgeon was mostly an absentee husband. He wasn't. Remember that his published sermons number more than 3,500. He edited almost every one of those individually. For most of them, Susie was at his side while he prepared to preach, while he was preparing the sermon, and then at his side again while he edited all of those sermon transcripts for publication. Obviously, these weren't exactly times of conversation, but both Charles and Susie spoke of the sweet comfort they felt just in being in the presence of one another. Even when the atmosphere was silent, there was a profound spiritual connection between these two souls. Susie described the love that she and Charles had for one another as the deepest love, she said. Years after he had gone to heaven, she spoke of it as a love which lives in my heart today as truly and more solemnly and strongly than it did in those early days. For although God has seen fit to call my beloved up to higher service, he has left me the consolation of still loving him with all my heart and believing that our love shall be perfected when we meet in that blessed land where love reigns supreme and eternal. Speaking of the hours that he spent studying and preparing sermons, I don't know if you've ever heard me describe his process for preparation to preach. He said they would always have guests at their house on Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening. He didn't begin preparing his sermons, and I don't recommend this to any preacher, but he didn't even begin preparing his sermon notes until after all the guests had left Saturday evening. He was going to preach on Sunday. And that was his normal routine. He said he would, at about 6 p.m., he would announce that his guests needed to leave. He said, I have a lot of chickens to scratch for, and so I need to spend some time getting the message together. And he would go off into his study and prepare his sermon. And there was one famous incident when he was struggling to come up with content for his Sunday sermon. It was already late Saturday night. He was exhausted. And so he went to bed and he told Susie, wake me up early so that I have time to prepare a sermon, which to me, that makes me smile. It takes me 8 to 10 hours to prepare a sermon. He actually just wrote out the outline and preached from that. And he had such a facility with words that he could do this extemporaneously. And it sounded like great writing. And then, of course, he edited a little bit later, and he would add some of that eloquence in the editorial process. But he could speak extemporaneously better than most of us can if we write out what we're going to say. But on this particular Saturday, he couldn't come up with anything, so he goes to bed early, tells her to wake him up. Supposedly, she says, he preached a full sermon in his sleep. And so she took down the points and gave him the outline the next morning. Now, again, I don't want to question what's recorded history, but I've always wondered if maybe she had a sermon in her mind, and I don't know. It was a good sermon, though. In fact, let me close this session by reading her account of that incident. On that particular Saturday evening, she says, quote, he sat up very late and was utterly worn out and dispirited, for all his efforts to get at the heart of the text were unavailing. So he had a text in mind. She says, I advised him to retire to rest and soothed him by suggesting that if he would try to sleep now, he would probably in the morning feel quite refreshed and able to study to better purpose. He said, "If I go to sleep now, wifey, will you wake me up very early so that I may have plenty of time to prepare?" She says, "With my loving assurance that I would watch the time for him and call him soon enough, he was satisfied, and like a trusting, tired child, he laid his head upon the pillow and slept soundly and sweetly at once." By and by, she says, a wonderful thing happened. During the first dawning hours of the Sabbath, I heard him talking in his sleep, and it roused myself to listen attentively. Soon I realized that he was going over the subject of the verse which had been so obscure to him, and he was giving a clear and distinct exposition of its meaning with much force and freshness. So she says, I set myself with almost trembling joy to understand and follow all that he was saying, for I knew that if I could but seize and remember the salient points of the discourse, he would have no difficulty in developing and enlarging upon them. So she only wants to take down the outline. By the way, I have strict instructions for Darlene. If I talk in my sleep, don't take down what I say. It's not going to make any good sense, but whatever. She says, "Never preacher had a more eager and anxious hearer than I was that morning. What if I should let the precious words slip? I had no means at hand of taking notes," she says. "So, like Nehemiah, I prayed to the God of heaven and asked that I might receive and retain the thoughts which he had given to his servant in his sleep and which were so singularly entrusted to my keeping." So she's just got to memorize the outline of this thing. And she says, "As I lay repeating over and over again the chief points I wished to remember, my happiness was very great in anticipation of his surprise and delight on awakening. But I had kept vigil so long, cherishing my joy, that I must have been overcome with slumber just when the usual time for rising came." So she overslept. "And he awoke with a frightened start, and seeing the telltale clock, said, 'Oh, wifey, you said you'd wake me up very early, and now see the time? Oh, why did you let me sleep? What shall I do? What shall I do?' 'Listen, beloved,' I answered, and I told him all that I had heard." "Why, that's just what I wanted," he exclaimed. "That is the true explanation of the whole verse. And you say I preached it in my sleep? It's wonderful." He repeated again and again, and we both praised the Lord for so remarkable a manifestation of his power and love. So the relationship between Charles and Susie is indeed a remarkable love story. If you want to look into it more deeply for yourself, I want to give you a few resources. Susanna Spurgeon wrote two autobiographical volumes. The first one is titled 10 Years of My Life in the Service of the Book Fund. It was written in 1886, about 6 years before Spurgeon died. Now, the Book Fund was her personal ministry because she was confined to home because of her illness. And what she did was take copies of her husband's books, autograph them with her name, and send them to pastors literally all over the world. And every now and then you'll find one of the Book Fund books in a used bookstore with Susie's handwriting in it. I've seen several of them. And she sent them all over the world. And it was called the Book Fund. And people paid for those books by donations. And she sent them out free to ministers everywhere. So she wrote this volume about 10 years, the first 10 years of the Book Fund, 1886. The sequel, 10 years after, was written in 1895. That was 3 years after Spurgeon's death. Both of these books can be read online. You'll find them at Google Books, or you can get reprint copies. I looked it up on Amazon, and somebody has reprinted these, so you can actually get them if you're interested. The short book that I mentioned earlier by Charles Ray, titled Mrs. C.H. Spurgeon, Charles Ray wrote the book in 1903. I said it was about 100 years ago. It was a little more than that. And it was then republished in 1973 by Pilgrim Publications out of Houston, Texas. For years, this was the only source of biographical material you could easily get a hold of on Mrs. Spurgeon, thanks to Pilgrim Publications. They don't exist anymore, but they republished everything Spurgeon had ever written and published. And their version of the book is now out of print, and Pilgrim, who, as I said, published more of Spurgeon's works than any other 20th century publisher. They're sadly now defunct, but if you want this book in its original format, you still might find a used copy if you look for it on eBay. And I think someone has also posted the full text of the book online in a web page, or you can get the photocopies of the original book at Google Books. So it's now easy to get. I think it's a short book. It's well worth reading. It has provided source material for virtually all of the other books about Susie Spurgeon. Now, also, Banner of Truth has a book titled Susanna Spurgeon. It includes the full but nicely re-edited text of the Charles Ray volume. So if you want the Charles Ray volume, you can find it in this Banner of Truth edition. Actually, this book was reprinted as a devotional book with the biographical material sort of added as an appendix, but it's all there. It includes the devotional portion of the book, which was originally a standalone volume. I think I have a picture of it here, called A Carolina Bells, Devotional Thoughts that she wrote down for women to read, published now more than 120 years ago, A Carolina Bells, subtitled To Ring Out the Old Truths of Free Grace and Dying Love. And it was one of three devotional books that she wrote. You can, again, do a Google search if you want to look for copies. Ray Rhodes is the living author who has written the most about Susanna Spurgeon. He has two books, both published by Moody. The first one is a nice 295-page hardcover titled simply Susie. I didn't put a picture of it here, but it's the definitive biography. It's the one I recommend. If you only want one, look for Susie by Ray Rhodes, and it's pretty easy to find. I think it's probably even still in print. Moody Press did it. And then they did a follow-up volume also by Ray Rhodes. This is a picture of that, titled Yours Till Heaven. And it's a detailed account of the love story between Charles and Susie. All of these books I recommend.